From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Firesign Theater was famous in the 60s and 70s for their absurd and surreal satires of hippie culture. Now they have their first CD of new material in nearly 20 years. It's set in a radio station on the eve of the millennium. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we listen to old and new Firesign recordings and hear from three of the group's four members. Also, we hear from John Frankenheimer, director of such films as The Manchurian Candidate, The Birdman of Alcatraz, and French Connection 2. His new film, Ronin, stars Robert De Niro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke is meeting again with Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Holbrooke is trying to persuade Yugoslavia to stop attacking ethnic Albanians living in Kosovo. He is also warning Yugoslav authorities they face the increased threat of NATO airstrikes if they don't comply with NATO demands.
NATO continues an intensifying planning in preparation for action, and we are continuing an intensifying diplomatic effort to see if that is going to be necessary or not.
Holbrooke continues to meet with Milosevic at this hour. Meanwhile, a leading senator on the Armed Services Committee has come out against resolutions supporting airstrikes in Kosovo. Virginia Senator John Warner says the draft resolutions do not take into account the aftermath of an air assault. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Amid the crush of policy and spending disputes on Capitol Hill, some lawmakers are circulating resolutions backing NATO airstrikes to halt the atrocities committed by Serb authorities in Kosovo, but not supporting the use of ground troops. Senator Warner, in line to take over the Armed Services panel next year, says he doesn't want to see American troops in Kosovo either, but he says taking the threat of ground troops off the table would be a tactical mistake.
You cannot plan an air operation without a concomitant means to secure the ground. Let me just pose the hypothetical. Suppose you strike with air and you're successful. Is Milosevic likely to sit there and do nothing? He could counterattack.
The dispute makes it unlikely that Congress will weigh in on the Kosovo issue before it wraps up business. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Commuters in Paris are struggling to get around because of a rail strike. Some transport employees walked off their jobs because they say they are targets for violence. Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
For all practical purposes, there is no commuter rail service into Paris. Some mainline trains are making unscheduled stops at suburban stations to help out passengers. The strike is to protest violence and vandalism aboard public transport vehicles. Disadvantaged young people in the tough neighborhoods on the commuter rail system often act out their frustration with French society by attacking trains or buses. Last night, Prime Minister Lionel Jospin called on parents to take charge of their kids. He said he'll stiffen sentences against people who attack transport workers and give conductors some police powers. But the strikers say they've got enough to do driving a crowded train. They want more personnel to handle relations with difficult passengers. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Chase in Paris.
A federal grand jury has indicted Russell Weston Jr. on six counts connected to the shootings at the U.S. Capitol last July, in which two Capitol Police officers were slain. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 20 points at 77.51. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after starting well this morning, the stock market has grown a little weaker. Wall Street is winding down a wild week, as NPR's Jack Spear reports.
In a week that's seen violent 200-plus point mood swings on Wall Street on a near-daily basis, things are a little bit calmer today. Wall Street seems to now be betting there will be another cut in interest rates, and soon. That caused a rise in some of the hard-hit computer stocks. It also gave financial services firms and banks a slight boost. Bank stocks have been pummeled lately on expectations. Continuing turmoil on global markets will lead to sharply lower third-quarter earnings. In corporate news, pharmaceutical services company Cardinal Health announced today it will buy Allegiance Corp in a stock swap deal. The merger, with debt factored in, is valued at just under $5.5 billion. Aircraft engine maker Pratt & Whitney said today it plans to cut 2,000 jobs in Connecticut and Florida over the next several years in an effort to cut costs and boost profits. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Business Week magazine says the University of Pennsylvania is still the best place to get a master's degree in business administration. The Weekly says the University's Wharton School offers the most highly regarded MBA program in the country. Business Week surveyed business school graduates and corporate recruiters to compile its list of the top 25 business schools. Number two was Northwestern, followed by the University of Chicago, which also won the most improved business school. The dollar continues to slide in value against the Japanese yen. In overseas financial trading, the American currency dropped more than 5 yen to 117. That's lower than yesterday's close in New York. The dollar began the week at 1 to 135 yen. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Because of us, it's morning in America.
Breakfast, honey?
Thanks. Hey, is this real pork?
Because of us, people in the Great Plains are just plain doing things. Little things, like taking money from machines.
Hey, stop, kid. I'm not a machine.
Because of us, they're roasting East Coast marshmallows on the West Coast.
Wow, these taste like pork.
We're the people of U.S. Plus. Guess what we do?
Chemistry?
Transportation?
Pork?
Kind of. U.S. Plus. We own the idea of America.
It's five past the last time to give
That's
you
the Firesign Theater from a new CD, their first studio recording of new material in nearly 20 years. It's called Give Me Immortality or Give Me Death, and it's set at a radio station on the eve of the millennium. The Firesign Theater was famous in the late 60s and the 70s for their surrealism, absurdities, non sequiturs, paranoia, parodies of the establishment, in-jokes about hippies, and knowing allusions to literature and trash culture. The Firesign Theater got its start on radio, then created intricately layered multi-track comedy records, such as Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All, and Don't Crush the Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. The Firesign Theater members reunited in the 90s, in 1993, after the release of a best-of anthology called Shoes for Industry. I spoke with three of the four Firesign members, David Osman, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman. We began with an excerpt of a classic Firesign Theater sketch, High School Madness.
Oh, bombs away, Dad. Morning, Mom.
Morning, sir.
Oh, hot dog, road cakes again. Heavy on the 30 weight, Mom.
Don't eat with your hands, son. Use your entrenching tool.
Oh, gee, Dad, I'm just trying to save time. It isn't every day a guy graduates from high school.
How many times have I heard that before?
Well, you boys fight it out among yourselves.
Okay, Mother.
Look at the time. Boy. I've got to dress for my bridge club.
Gee, Mom, isn't that bridge built yet?
No, son. And it won't be until free hands on both sides of the big ditch can press the same button at the same time.
Okay, Dad, I give. Oh, boy, can I eat my breakfast now?
Only if you stay out of trouble, boy. Your shenanigans could cost me this election.
Let's start by going around the room, and I'll ask of each of you to say your names and do at least one of the voices that we'll recognize you by.
Well, you just heard David Osman doing, can I do it? Porgy Tire Biter. I do it in the show, but it's hard to get there anymore because now I'm about 40 years older than this character is really supposed to be. And the other one, I guess, that's really well known is, or the old man is old, he's either Dan Catherwood, the famous butler from Nick Danger, or the elderly George Tirebiter, who has a slightly different voice. Young and old, that's me, same time.
Well, I'm Peter Bergman, and in Dwarf, well, I play Mudhead, you know, gee, Porge. I didn't know you masturbated. You know,
golly,
that's my line. And on the other hand, in Nick Danger, I'm the tough Lieutenant Bradshaw. Shut up, Danger. That's how you'll recognize me.
Well, my name's Phil Proctor, and... Hiya, friends. Ralph Sparsport, Ralph Sparsport Motors.
Hello, Mr. Danger, you stupid fool. Oh, Nick, you're such a tool. Good morning, fellow kids. This is Principal Poop, etc., etc.
A man of many voices and a polyglot. He speaks many languages.
I can speak out of both sides of my mouth at the same time.
Yes. Let's do a little bit of fire sign history here. You guys got together when you had a radio show called...
Yeah, Peter. Again,
what was
Radio
the show
Free
called?
Oz.
Radio Free Oz. This was on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles.
KPFK.
Listener supported.
So what kind of stuff were you doing then?
Well, this started in the summer of 1966, and FM then basically was dedicated to classical music and was not a big entertainment, pop entertainment medium at all. And I'd heard Bob Fass's show on BAI just before I came out to
That's
California.
That's the New York Pacifica
He's
station.
Still on. Yeah. BAI. And he was doing mixes of sound and all kind of, and I was very much involved in what was then the avant-garde pop culture. I'd been tangentially with the Living Theater. I'd been over in Europe. I was in a playwriting seminar with a young guy named Tom Stoppard, a young guy named Piers Paul Reed, and a young guy named Derek Marlowe, and me. There's these four 24-year-olds writing.
In Berlin,
and that's where Stoppard wrote Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, was in this little house where we all worked. So I came back all full of the avant-garde, went out to California, started this radio show, and I was playing Indian music, and Andy Warhol was on in the Buffalo Springfield, and all this pop culture, and astrology, and tarot, and it was a crazy late-night show, and people were going mad behind it. And in walked Phil Proctor, that I worked with in drama from Yale. He was the leading man in the musicals that I had worked with. David Osmond had just left the station as its PD and gone to put a suit on with ABC, which was not making him very happy. And Phil Austin was engineering and kind of co-producing the show. Well, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, really out of nowhere, the four of us got together. I'd been doing comedy on Radio Free Oz already. We decided to do this thing called the Oz...
Film Festival.
Film Festival Jury. And just before we went on the show that night, November 17th, 1966, I, who was an astrologer at the time, Monkey, I said, well, you're all fire signs. We're all fire signs. We're the fire sign. We're the Oz Fire Sign Theater. And we went on. And let me introduce a couple of the people that were on the show that night. On my left is, at least in his own country, a legend in his own mind, Jean-Claude, the leader of the Nouvelle Vague Vague.
Yes, well, the Vague Vague, we call
and
it.
And you have a new... You have a, what film figure. Are you bringing to the Oz Film Festival?
24 Hour with Georges.
Fred.
Fred. Yes. That's the American translation.
All right.
In French, it's Georges with an S at the end. Everybody thinks it's misprint, so we changed to Fred.
Yeah, and which, 24 Hours in the Life of Fred, is it
yes.
It's very much that?
Une journée dans la vie de Fred.
Yeah.
Yes, it is for me being, you know, documentary filmmaker to capture reality of life, two most important thing. So I was follow my friend Fred, Georges, around the Paris, in where he live, and film for a complete day of this life. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. He sleeps, we sleep. He goes to bathroom, we go to bathroom. He does nothing, we do nothing.
And how does the film end? What terminates the film?
I run out of film.
Uh-huh.
At the end.
I see.
So you did the radio show for quite a while, and then you ended up making the records that made you nationally famous. Mm-hmm. There was this incredible overlayering. So at the same time that you were using all these double meanings and non sequiturs and puns and stuff, there were layers and layers happening at the same time. How did you start using that kind of, for the time, very sophisticated use of audio?
It was there.
Yeah,
it was there, and we came right from radio where there was one mic, and as you say, it was mono. Radio was entirely mono at that time. And we went into a studio, and we had four tracks, which is how many tracks the Beatles had to make Sgt. Pepper.
That means you had a piece of tape that had four channels, basically, you could record on.
And so we could continue. We would fill up two of those tracks to get stereo, and then we'd bounce it down, ping-pong it, they call it, down to one of the tracks. And then we'd still have three, and we'd do another one. We'd mix it and bounce it down again. And as we went along, we had every advance in the technology of recording that was available came to us as we walked into the studio, really, to do each one of our records.
That's
so
right.
Stereo was there for us. We had our first record, Waiting for the Electrician, was released in mono as well as in stereo.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are the rare ones, the mono ones.
Wow.
And then we had 8-track, and then we went to 16-track, and the Dolbys
quadraphonic
were wheeled in.
Quadraphonic, when it came in. A couple of albums were done. 8-track quadraphonic. Somebody sent me one of those.
One thing to notice, though, is that we actually took advantage of what was there. It was
absolutely.
our nature.
It was our playroom.
To use this, I had made a record as a high school. I released a record in high school, which I made on my webcore, which I'd cut. And so that, therefore, the idea of having more tracks and being able to use, because we're all theater types, more voices, mm-hmm. was natural to the agreement of the group. I mean, we could have gone in there and just done stand-up routines or just done theater routines that were completely linear, but we didn't think in a linear way.
There were too many of us.
My guests are David Osman, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman of the Firesign Theater. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are David Osman, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman of the comedy group Firesign Theater.
Let's talk about Nick Danger. This is one of the pieces that you're best known for.
I always want to talk about Nick Danger.
Shut
Why don't
up,
you talk
Rococo.
About me? Leave me alone, Bradshaw. You're an idiot.
Sorry, there's no controlling him.
This is Nick Danger, Third Eye, your Private Eye parody. Why don't I just play a little bit of it first?
Okay. Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly, ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly, toward his weekly meeting with the unknown. At 4th and Drucker, he turns left. At Drucker and 4th, he turns right. He crosses MacArthur Park and walks into a great sandstone building.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, he steps inside. Climbs the 13 steps to his office. He walks in. He's ready for mystery. He's ready for excitement. He's ready for anything. He's...
Nick Danger, Third Eye.
I want to order a pizza to go and no anchovies.
No anchovies? You've got the wrong man. I spell my name, Danger.
What?
The makers of fantastic cigarettes, long in the leaf and short in the can, bring you another true story from the tattered casebook of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Let's join him now in the adventure we call...
Cut him off at the past!
Let's get down to business. Uncross those beautiful stems of yours, baby. Here's the case I call number 666. It all began innocently enough on Tuesday. I was sitting in my office on that drizzly afternoon, listening to the monotonous staccato of rain on my desktop and reading my name on the glass of my office door. Regnad Kisten. My secretary lay snoring on the floor, her long, beautiful gams pinioned under the couch. I didn't hear him enter, but my nostrils flared at the smell of his perfume. Pyramid patchouli. There was only one joker in L.A. sensitive enough to wear that scent. And I had to find out who he was.
Good afternoon, Mr. Danger. I'm Rocky Rococo.
Thanks, Half Pint. You just saved me a lot of investigative work.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Do you know what this is?
I had to think for a minute. What cruel game was he playing?
That's a brown paper bag.
That's correct. Now, look inside, Mr. Danger. What do you see?
That's easy. That's a pickle.
Very good. Now I think you're ready for this.
Why, that's nothing but a two-bit ring from a crackerback jocks.
I'll sell it to you for $5,000.
What kind of a chump do you take me for?
First class.
That tarnished piece of tin is worthless.
Worthless? Not to Melanie Haber.
Melanie Haber?
You may remember her as Audrey Farber.
Audrey Farber?
Susan Underhill?
Susan Underhill?
How about Betty Jo Bielowski?
Betty Jo Bielowski. I hadn't heard that name since college. Everyone knew her as Nancy. Then it all came rushing back to me like the hot kiss at the end of a wet fist. It was pig night at the Om Mani Padme Sigma house.
Who came up with the idea of Nick Danger? Tell us how that sketch originated.
Boy, does anybody remember that? Right. I remember where we wrote it. Yeah. We wrote it in a mansion, sort of, that you were living in Encino.
Dr. Adolph's place.
Yes. That's not where we wrote all of Nick Danger. I can tell you very specifically that we wrote a lot of Nick Danger in your house on Alvarado Street. Absolutely. And I'll tell you what the impulse was to do it is that we were offered a radio show by our friend Jack Poet that we were going to do down at this big Elks Hall down in MacArthur Park.
Yeah.
And we wrote it for that, for a live radio show in this big gothic temple almost.
They had the biggest American flag in the United States hanging in the billiard room of that Masonic temple.
And they had
an
organ and all this sort of stuff. So we wrote Nick Danger for it. It never got done there. We never did that show.
No.
That never happened. But I don't remember that anybody thought of the idea of Nick Danger per se. Someone did, but it just happened organically out of the four of us. All of us had listened to Radio Detectives as youths, so nobody came in and had to explain to us what it was all about.
Because it was written for a radio show, it was simple, in quotes. It was a radio show.
Yeah.
And there's a photo that I recall of our recording sessions where we had four microphones. The only difference between the original broadcast, we would have been on one RCA Omni microphone. Here we were on four mics. But Phil has a walking platform, and he's doing footsteps as he's recording. We had prop door, that is a sound effects door from CBS. And we wandered all over the CBS radio buildings into the cellars and dragged out all of this old 1930s and 40s sound effect stuff, all painted battleship gray and stenciled CBS on it.
Right.
And the sound didn't sound right. There was something wrong with the way it sounded. And we said, can we please see your microphones? And they said, sure, okay. And they opened up this big cupboard and we said, those! And, of course, they were the microphones that would have been used back in 1938, the old RCA 77 mics, ribbon microphones, and the sound was just right. It flattered the voices, the male voices, because almost all the actors on radio were male in those days.
Except maybe for Nancy.
Well, that's why we all play her, you know what I mean? And so it really is very authentic to the thing itself. It was recorded in a radio studio with the original radio mics, with the original radio sound effects. And at the time we wrote it, though, we had no idea that we were going to do it on a record. That was really an afterthought.
Yeah,
and yet it's surreal, which radio in those days, Golden Age radio was almost completely non-surreal.
That's
true. Part of what made the work surreal was that you'd go with these kind of like long strings of puns and non sequiturs.
Mm-hmm.
And the non sequiturs were all really funny, but I was wondering how you would write non sequiturs.
Well, there are four of us.
Yeah,
non sequitur is our middle name. I mean, because somebody would always top the other person. Or Phil, as you've been listening for the last 10 minutes, is a little voice in the background. If there's a hole, he fills
it.
And we also all know what we're going to say next, usually after a certain length of time, and so we can echo each other.
And anticipate each other.
There you have
it. And non sequiturs we are by nature producers of non sequiturs. I mean, I deal in them regularly. Live it or live with it. Now that's
shoes for industry, shoes for the dead.
Mm-hmm. And shoes for industry is something I picked up. I taught labor law. But it was part of labor history. And Shoes for Industry, I wrote my thesis on the Wobblies, and I found Shoes for Industry through studying the radical labor movement, industrial workers of the world.
Yeah, it turned out that the Wobblies had disguised themselves as women and were wearing high heels when they were picketing so that they wouldn't be beaten up by the police. And the cops said, look at those guys wobbling around there, and then they went and beat the bejesus out of them, and that's why they were called Wobblies.
Thank you, Phil. Shoes for Industry, and then we added Shoes for the Dead. I mean, shoes for the dead.
Well, it was returning dead war veterans.
But that idea of deceased war veteran, what chance does a returning deceased war veteran have for that good job? That's non sequitur thinking. It does bring up the fact that we're sending people off with promises knowing they're going to come back in body bags, but it's still a non sequitur.
Mm-hmm. It's also important to know that the world is made up of non sequiturs, particularly the print world at that time.
All of politics
all collected. I think there's a very good political example, Terry, in the politician's speech in Waiting for the Electrician, where he talks about falling over like a bridge. Mm. Does anybody remember the
That was
the
schizophrenic writing. I found that in a mad person's, well, who's to say how
You found
mad.
It on the street.
I found it on the street,
Piece
and it was
paper.
Written by an eccentric who fancied himself as a politician running for president. And it was, we must pull together as a bridge.
Like a drum.
Like a drum. It was mad writing. I have since then collected as much mad writing as I can, and, you know, it's wonderful. I understand it, of course.
When I had a radio show in Buffalo in the mid-70s, one of the things, I'd play your records all the time on the air, but one of the things I would do would be to use the commercials. Phil, would you do one of your commercials for us and tell us how you came up with it?
Oh, sure. Hiya, friends. Roush Sportsport Motors, the world's largest used, new, and new lewd automobile dealership, Roush Sportsport Motors, here in the city of emphysema. Let's just take a look at the extras on this totally used automobile. Two-way sneeze-through wind vents, edible, sponge-coated steering column, star-studded mudguards, chrome fender dents, and factory air-conditioned air from our fully factory-equipped factory. It's a beautiful car, friends, with doors to match. Birch's Blacklist says this car was carjacked, but for you, friends, a complete price, only $25,500, an easy monthly payments of $25 a week, twice a week, and never on Sunday. That was based on Ralph Williams. See, I came out to Los Angeles from New York. I was raised in the Midwest and basically schooled on the East Coast. And I'd never experienced the left coast, that other coast. And when I came out and saw the entirely different culture and the things that people were getting away with and the strangeness of the television culture out there, first of all, I watched a lot of television because I didn't know how to drive. I was an East Coast guy. You take a cab or a bus or a subway or you walk and sled. And I spent a lot of time watching television. I saw Ralph Williams on the television all the time. This guy had
three different channels.
He bought up television time. He was on the air all the time selling these cars and talking like that. He sounded like that. And he was a little bald, kind of chubby, gnomish looking guy. And he was selling all these cars and he'd go down a row of cars. He was like a truck, you know, with a camera on it, would go down this row of cars and he'd say, you know, $365, $275, $800. And $65. They're all beautiful cars, friends. And this rhythm, this mantra, which became, you know, like a hypnotic mantra to me. So I parodied it naturally. And since I was doing real commercials also at the same time, I was into the forms. I understood the forms of the cell. And just like all of us did with Firestone, and I wanted to hook people in to think that they were listening to something real so that I could then surprise them with a political joke or a satirical joke. And that way would also decondition them from listening to commercials and just letting it wash over them, you know, and accepting and being brainwashed by them.
Members of the Firesign Theater recorded in 1993. Here's more from their new CD, Give Me Immortality or Give Me Death. This is Fresh Air.
Wake up, Rob. Wake up, Rob.
Wake up.
They've come to steal my dreams.
Wake up.
Knock the door down. Go away. Go away.
Rise now and turn over your old mattress.
To me, Lord Eddie.
Oh, Lord, I can't. There's
monsters?
There's money in that mattress.
That's right. There's monster money in every sweaty mattress when you trade in your used dreams at
Unconscious Village.
But those dreams have been with me since the beginning.
Don't be stuck with leftover dreams in the terrible days to come.
Open mattress.
Oh, look!
A pig!
Looks
like a locomotive! It tastes like flowers!
A man with scorpions in his yo-yo!
It's not happening, monkeys. It's not
posting info.
Hello, don't worry.
A noble woman condemned to multiple births.
Coming up, the director of The Manchurian Candidate, The Birdman of Alcatraz, and French Connection 2, John Frankenheimer. His new film, Ronin, stars Robert De Niro. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Right at the fork. Marechal Foch. Okay, you're in front of him. You can cut him off at the end of the porch.
Roger that. I got it.
That's the sound of one of the spectacular car chases in the new action thriller Ronin, starring Robert De Niro. It's about spies who've been put out of work by the end of the Cold War. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with the director of Ronin, John Frankenheimer. He first made a name for himself in his 30s, directing live TV drama. He directed the series Playhouse 90 for 6 years in the mid-1950s. One of his shows was the highly acclaimed drama The Days of Wine and Roses. During his first years directing films in the 50s and early 60s, he became the favorite director of Burt Lancaster, directing him in 5 films, including Birdman of Alcatraz. Frankenheimer's other movies include The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, The French Connection 2, The Fixer, Black Sunday, and 52 Pickup. I spoke with Frankenheimer in 1990 after the release of his political thriller, The Fourth War.
You've done several films about the military, 7 Days in May, The Manchurian Candidate. You went to military school as a child, right?
Yes, it's true.
Did you feel like that gave you insights into the military mind at all?
Yes, I do. And I also was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War and things like that. And yes, I do. I feel that it's given me a tremendous insight into the military mind, especially on higher levels, because I was around general officers a lot. And it's helped me.
When you were General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War, what did that entail?
Well, it entailed photographing the general quite a bit. It entailed,
right.
It entailed also doing some training films. I was in the Air Photographic Squadron that did a lot of training films in the United States. That's how I started, actually.
Started making movies.
Yeah.
Did you prefer making documentary films for the military to fighting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not a fool. I mean, I'm not crazy. Yeah, I loved it.
I want to ask you a little bit about The Manchurian Candidate, which I think is just a really extraordinary movie. You were the co-producer of the movie. I assume that means that you were one of the people who were behind making it, as opposed to a director who was brought on after the idea.
Yes,
was already in
yes.
Effect.
In this particular case, George Axelrod and I bought the book. We developed it, and then I ended up directing it, of course.
How did Sinatra get involved with the movie?
Well, Sinatra was the whole element that made the movie possible. The movie had been turned down by every studio in town. And when George Axelrod and I bought the book, we bought it by buying the book in a bookstore. It had been optioned and re-optioned and dropped and never been able to be made. And we knew that Frank Sinatra had read the book, and Frank Sinatra was interested in the picture, but he had never really gone the whole nine yards and optioned it. So we optioned it, and without a script, Frank Sinatra committed to it. And, of course, by the right away, as soon as he committed to it, we had the necessary financing to make the movie.
Did you have any idea he'd be as good as he was in it? I mean, did you have as much faith in his acting abilities when you started?
No. I didn't want to make the movie with Frank Sinatra. I was scared of it. I had heard he was very difficult. I had heard that he treated directors badly, all those things. I expressed these reservations to George Axelrod, and he said, look, he said, I'm going to make the movie with Frank Sinatra, whether you do it or whether you don't. He said, I'll buy you out, but I want to make this movie with Sinatra. Sinatra is going to get this picture made. And if you have problems with Sinatra, he said, I would suggest that you discuss them with him instead of discussing them with me. And I made an appointment to see Mr. Sinatra. I went up to see him at his house, and I expressed my reservations to him. And he said, look, I guarantee you whether what you've heard is true, whether what you've heard is not true, there is my side to all that, too. He said, I want to do this picture, I want to work with you, and I feel that we're going to get along just fine. And that was the last discussion we ever had. We got along absolutely fabulously. I loved working with Frank Sinatra. It was a joy making that picture. It was one of the happiest experiences in my life making that picture, and I loved everything that Sinatra did. I mean, he was just a joy to work with, and we've been close friends ever since.
There's a scene I have to ask you about. It's really an extraordinary scene. This is the Garden Club dream scene. Frank Sinatra is having these recurring nightmares in which he's with all of the men from his army troop from the Korean War. He's with them at a ladies' garden club, and suddenly the ladies' garden club turns into a lot of Korean soldiers, and the head Korean soldier is discussing how he's brainwashing these soldiers into believing that they're at a garden party. And then to show how brainwashed they really are, he has Lawrence Harvey just walk over and strangle to death one of the men. You shot that scene in such a disorienting way. The camera just kind of revolves around all the women of the garden club first, and then suddenly the women are transformed into men, and you're as confused as Frank Sinatra is by all of this. Tell me about how you decided to shoot this scene.
Well, number one, the idea of the scene came right out of Richard Condon's book. He described pretty well what the scene should look like. So it was up to me to interpret it. And the shot that you're talking about is a 360-degree shot, which starts on the stage of a hotel in New Jersey where a woman is talking about hydrangeas, and we pan around the room, and you think that it's just women listening to this, a garden club. And then as the camera completes its 360-degree arc, you suddenly find yourself on a stage in an amphitheater in Korea, and the Chinese psychiatrist is talking about brainwashing. So what we did was we designed a set that could be moved, and it took a little athletic ability from the actors to run from one platform to the other while we were back on the garden club. And the two platforms were on a kind of a railroad track, and we slid one right in place as the camera moved off the first one. But what it did was it set in the audience's mind that this was not just the magic in the movies, that something very strange here was happening, because we never cut. And the audience realizes when you cut. They might not know what it is, but they know that there's been some mechanical device put between them and the story. And I wanted to do it all in one shot. And I think after we accomplished that shot, then we were able to cut to anything that we wanted to do. And we filmed that sequence with about seven or eight different combinations: the women in Korea, the Chinese Manchurian delegates in New Jersey, the actors on the New Jersey stage hotel, the actors in the Korean amphitheater. And we were able to intercut it at will, back and forth. And after the first shot, the suspension of disbelief with the audience was complete. So we were able to kind of manipulate them back and forth whenever we wanted to. And you're right, we did cut it in such a way that it was confusing, and deliberately so.
Now, one of the black men from this same troop that Sinatra was in has the same dream. But when he has the dream, all of the women from the ladies' club are black. Was that in the novel, or is that your invention, to have the two people have their own version of this same dream?
That was me. What I never did do, I mean, I had it done, but I just didn't dare take the shot of it. In the back of the room, we had a white bellboy. But we never did show it. If you look carefully, you can see it.
That's great. It's a wonderful. It's wonderful the way you contrast the two dreams.
You know, I want to tell you one other thing about that movie. That's something that I don't think people are aware of, but I think it's important to say in these days and times, which is that that was one of the first movies where the producer and director used a black actor to play a part that was not written for a black. Today it's done quite often, but that was very new at the time, to take the black actor, cast him as the psychiatrist, and that part was not written for a black actor. I've since done it quite a bit, but I just wanted to bring that up.
John Frankenheimer is my guest. The movie was released in 1962. This was just before the Kennedy assassination. The Manchurian Candidate was out of circulation for 26 years. It was re-released in 1987. I know Frank Sinatra was a friend of Kennedy. Is that why the movie was out of circulation for so long?
No,
It had nothing to do with the assassination?
No.
What is the story?
The story is basically one of greed, of money, as most American stories are. The movie was out of circulation for the simple reason that United Artists carried the movie through a complicated process of Chinese bookkeeping, totally in the red for years and years and years. They had it cross-collateralized with every other movie that Frank Sinatra had made for United Artists. And we were so far in the red that if we had been E.T. and re-released, we would have been in the red. And when this movie finished its run, which was before the president's assassination, there were no ancillary markets as you know them today. There was no tape. There was no cable. There just wasn't anything like that. And what there was network television and then syndicated television. And then you went into the archives, which all these movies did. And in fact, The Manchurian Candidate did play on network television one time around. However, what they failed to realize was that in 1970, the rights reverted to Frank Sinatra, the rights for re-release. They had just thrown this in as a bone in his contract to get him to agree to other things. And it was the best thing in the world for us because what happened was that a market was developed for the movie. I mean, the press loved the movie. The media loved the movie. And the more people talked about the movie, the less it became possible to see it. And what happened was finally there was a management in place at United Artists for 25 minutes or long enough for us to negotiate a deal with them so that we could start out from scratch and we were neither in the red nor in the black to re-release the movie. And that's what we did. And it turned out very nicely for all of us.
My guest is film director John Frankenheimer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director John Frankenheimer.
You were good friends with Bobby Kennedy, and I believe you were with him the night that he was assassinated.
Yes, I was.
And he was supposed to go to your house afterwards. I think you were working with him on campaign ads.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, he was staying at my house, actually, and I drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, and I had done his film and television during his campaign, yes.
What effect did it have on you when he was assassinated?
Terrible. Really, honest to God, Terry, terrible. I had, in layman's terms, a nervous breakdown. I moved to Europe. I stayed in Europe for 7 years after that. It just was really, it was a terrible traumatic effect on me.
Was it because, I mean, I guess I understand why, but was it because you were that close or because of the suddenness and because of the assassination?
All of it.
Yeah.
I was close to him. I honestly believed, and I had let myself be totally convinced that this man would have been a superb president of the United States, and I honestly believe that to this day. And to see that all shattered in that one horrible moment was just more than I could accept.
I
had a very bad time after it.
So you left the States for a while?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I know it was because of that. I let it be. I kind of made believe it was for other reasons, but that was basically what the reason was.
And how did that affect your movie career? I mean, you weren't here making movies for several years.
No, but I made movies in Europe, and I made some good ones.
Which ones did you make in Europe?
Well, I made The Fixer. I made a movie called The Horseman. I made Impossible Object. French Connection 2.
That was in Europe?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, it was in France. What am I, what am I thinking? I just think of that as an American film.
Well, good. But, I mean, yeah, the whole thing took place in Marseille.
Right.
And I had a pretty active career over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you about French Connection, too. The way I understand it, Gene Hackman called you, said they want to do a sequel to French Connection 1. Why did he call you?
Well, number one, he didn't.
Okay. Tell me the real story.
The real story is that I had a story and Fox had a title. 20th Century Fox had a commitment with Gene Hackman, and they had a title, French Connection 2.
Uh-huh.
They had no story. I had a very, very interesting story, which was a narcotics cop being turned into a drug addict. And I thought, and I couldn't get it made, and I thought, wait a minute, this could work for French Connection 2. And I went to 20th Century Fox, and we sold them the idea of this story. And they loved it. And then we sold it to Gene Hackman, with whom I had worked on the Gypsy Moths some years before.
Yeah, well, what happens is, you know, Hackman goes to Marseille to track down the head of this drug ring, and they end up shooting him up with heroin and getting him addicted, and then he has to go through cold turkey. Tell me about the dramatic possibilities you saw in the story that you created here of having the narcotics agent become an addict himself.
Well, I thought it was... I love irony, and I thought that was the ultimate irony, especially to have Popeye Doyle become a drug addict, a cop that was so against this and was so adamant that he would never do this kind of thing, and to have this happen to him. And then, of course, Hackman is such a wonderful actor. The idea of having Hackman go through this whole cold turkey withdrawal was something that I thought the possibilities were endless, and I think he was brilliant in those scenes, incidentally.
Well, some of your early work was in live television doing dramas. You did a lot of Playhouse 90s.
I did, yes. I did 153 live television shows.
Yeah, that's really a lot. Was there a lot of improvising required on your part as a director? If something would go wrong, you'd have to just kind of follow through on it.
Strangely, in the 153 shows that I did, very few things ever went wrong. We went into the shows very, very well prepared. Don't forget, we rehearsed in most of those shows for over 3 weeks. We had 4 days on camera. We had a highly, highly trained and expert camera crew. Every shot was predetermined. Every shot was thought out. Every shot had been marked in my script long before we ever got on camera. The most horrendous things that ever happened to me in live television was when I was an assistant director and not in control of my own destiny. I remember when I was an assistant director and Eva Marie Saint and Francis L. Sullivan were on this show and they were supposed to be flying 50,000 feet above the Himalayas and be crash land and be rescued by these Chinese ski troops. We were in this set, which was about the size of a postage stamp with the two actors. And suddenly Francis L. Sullivan, who was making his live television debut, just went up. I mean, he just couldn't remember his lines. It was supposed to be 50,000 feet above the Himalayas, and he just looked into the camera. He said, my stop. He says, I think I'll get off. And he just got up, and he walked off the set. And we cut to the camera one, which was on the commercial announcer, and there was no sound on the commercial announcer. And you saw him talking to the agency man, and over this you heard this English accent saying, 40 years in this bloody business, and oh, I've never got up. And suddenly the sound came on over the commercial announcer, and he starts doing the Armstrong Cork commercial. I mean, it was just an unbelievable mess, at which point I was on the phone to Master Control in New York, and we were doing it from New York, and I said, look, you've got to take us off the air. There's nothing we can do now. It's just gone. Do anything. Just run a movie, anything. And they did take us off the air. That's the only time that that's ever happened.
Director John Frankenheimer recorded in 1990. His new film, Ronin, stars Robert De Niro. Coming up, actor Brad Dourif, the voice of the killer doll Chucky, returns in the comic sequel, Bride of Chucky. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The new movie, The Bride of Chucky, will be released next week. It's a comic sequel to the 1988 horror film Child's Play. In the original, Brad Dourif played a psychotic serial killer who's killed in a toy store in a shootout with a cop. As Dourif is dying, he says an incantation that transfers his soul and voice to the body of a doll in the store. And of course, the doll comes alive and becomes a killer. Brad Dourif is also in the new sequel. On this archive edition, we have a 1988 interview with him. Brad Dourif's first major screen role was in the 1975 film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He played Billy, a suicidal mental patient with a crippling stutter and a mother fixation. Dourif was nominated for an Oscar for the part. In many of his subsequent television and movie roles, Dourif has played psychotics and killers. In the film The Eyes of Laura Mars, he played a murder suspect, and in John Huston's Wise Blood, he starred as the obsessed founder of the Church Without Christ. I asked Dourif why he so often gets cast as a psycho.
People spend a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars on movies, and if you start to do something and people can see that you do it, then they tend to want to go with you because you know, there it's a sure thing. I think that's one reason. Number two, I kind of get scared when I audition, so people see a lot of fear, so that helps reinforce that.
No, it's interesting that you bring up fear, because your face does really register fear well.
Yeah.
But it's an almost aggressive kind of fear, so that the person watching you would be afraid about what you'd be doing to them, even though you're registering fear.
Yeah. Well, anger is real close to fear, and it just tends to go that way with me, I guess. When I get scared, I start to look angry. It's kind of my defense.
We have very intense eyes, you know.
Thank you. I think that's also responsible for it.
Do you take it personally that you've been cast as psychotic so often?
I gotta say that occasionally, my feelings get a little hurt. You know, I say, geez, if I kill one more person or if I have to rape one more woman or beat my wife up one more time, you know? Yeah.
Have you gotten to the point, though, of almost like giving in and starting to enjoy the role and finding yourself, finding yourself like looking around in cities and people on trains at the crazier looking people, looking for things that you can pick up on and add to your next role?
Well, yeah, of course I've been in the market for a long time for, you know, new crazy moves, so I do look around. But I'm really, you know, now I'm sort of like, I'm going to try to change that. I've decided that I'm going to be real serious about doing other things. So I'm turning down crazies these days.
Well, before we get to some of the crazies you've turned down, let's get to the latest crazy role that you're in.
Okay.
And that's the new movie Child's Play. And I was disappointed to find that you were killed off right after the opening credit sequence. And your spirit survives and inhabits the body of a child's doll.
Mm-hmm.
So your voice is still there, but your body's gone.
Right.
Did you know you were going to be killed off that quickly when you accepted the role?
Yeah, I did. And that was kind of like the challenge of the role, to sort of remain kind of a force in the picture, but not, you know, have my mug there. Just do it with my voice.
Was the doll designed with you in mind at all, for there to be some similarity or of gesture or of anything, so that there'd be a connection for the audience when your spirit inhabits the doll's body?
Yes. They had me do some taping, and I danced around and did some moving, and also I set all the lines, sort of acted the scenes out for them before they went and did it.
I'm interested in your background. I know little about you. I read somewhere that you went to prep school.
Yeah, I went to a place called Aiken Prep for 3 years in South Carolina, and then I went for another 3 years in Colorado to a prep school there. So I did 6 years of time.
Were you from a prosperous background?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. My grandfather built a factory in West Virginia, made dye, ultramarine blue. And so we had some money when I was growing up.
It's funny because...
It's gone now.
Is it? Is it really?
Yeah, yeah.
You almost always play scruffy on screen.
That could be have to do with some kind of upper middle class guilt, perhaps. I don't know. But I like doing scruffy.
Did you have to wear uniforms when you were in school?
Yep, I did. I had to wear, first school I went to, I had to wear one uniform in the morning, then a sports uniform, and then another uniform at night. And then when I went out riding, I had to wear a riding uniform. And everything we did, we had a uniform.
Oh, so it's fun and relaxing to be scruffy, huh? After
yes, it is.
In the press kit bio of you for the new movie Child's Play,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the first sentence in your bio starts, "Personally, Dourif is a gentleman." As if readers really need to be reassured that you're not you're not genuinely crazy. I was wondering if you ever find yourself in places like supermarkets where people look just vaguely uncomfortable about you, as if they've maybe seen you before and find you a little suspicious, but they don't know why.
Twice. That really happened to me. One time I was in a jewelry store and somebody looked at me and went white as a sheet. And they'd just seen a movie where I had played a killer. And then the second time I met a woman at a party and she became really scared and she said, "I think that man is psychotic. I just, there's something tells me that she's psychotic," and asked. I heard about it later on. Somebody told me that she had to leave the party and everything because she was sure I was, you know, going to kill somebody.
That's really funny.
Brad Dourif, recorded in 1988. He's featured in The Bride of Chucky, which opens next week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Kathy Wolfe and Roberta Shurrock. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song by Rosemary Clooney. This week she was given the Ella, the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of Singers.
I'm just about as solitary as anyone could be. Of course, my life is not so merry, but that's all right with me. No love, no nothing, until my baby comes home. No, sir, no nothing, as long as baby must roam. I promised him I'd wait for him till even Hades froze. I'm lonesome, heaven knows, but what I said still goes. No love, no nothing, and that's a promise I'll keep. No fun with no one, I'm getting plenty of sleep. My heart's on strike, and though it's like an empty honeycomb. No love, no sir, no nothing till my baby comes home.
And that's a promise I'll keep. No fun with no one. I'm getting plenty of sleep. My heart's on strike, and though it's like an empty honeycomb, no love, no sir, no nothing till my baby comes home. No love, no sir, no nothing till my baby comes home.